Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Betsy Fentress, and I am delighted to have with us today a wonderful priest with a fascinating story and a tremendous eye when it comes to Christian art, Father Patrick Vanderhorst. He worked with Sotheby's Auction House in Europe for 15 years before being ordained to the priesthood, where he was a specialist in 18th century French furniture. More recently, he has started Christian.art, where you can get a picture of the day's gospel, or I should say an artwork of some kind, and a reflection from Father. What a wonderful time to consider how art speaks to us, especially during Holy Week. And so, Father, you come to us from Westminster Cathedral in London, where you are anchored. And tell us a little bit about how you ended up going from Sotheby's to Westminster Cathedral.
I always wanted to work in the art world. So I grew up in Belgium. And when I was 23, I wanted to work for one of the big London auction houses. So in 1995, I moved to London and I got a job at Sotheby's. And so I worked there for nearly 20 years, as you said, very kindly in the introduction, as a furniture expert, and then overseeing the furniture division for Europe. And then during that time, but already ever since being a young boy, this attraction towards the priesthood was always there. But I thought I could keep it sort of to one side by throwing myself in the art world, and which is a wonderful world to work in. And I thought that would get rid of the itch that I had to maybe one day become a priest. But God has other plans and he's very persistent. So in my mid-40s, then I applied to the Diocese of Westminster and then the Cardinal Vincent Nichols and kindly accepted me and trained me towards the priesthood.
So I can't wait to talk about all the various facets of how art is playing a role in your priesthood. But most recently, with Holy Week, you produced a series called Tableau Vivant. Could you tell us about that series where you bring each station to life with living art and how this came to be?
Yes, so we put out the video and it's now has over 1 million views. And so very much the idea behind the video is that it's a video for people to pray the stations with. So it's not me explaining an artwork depicting the stations. No, it's very much with the idea in mind that you sit in front of your computer or laptop, take half an hour and pray the stations. And so the way we've done it is that we work together with a theatre company here in England called Wintershall, who do the Passion Play on Trafalgar Square. So in this very sort of highly secularized setting of a square here in central London, there is this beautiful Christian and Catholic witness of performing the Passion Play, always at Easter and on Good Friday in particular. And so we worked together with them for them to depict the 14 stations of the cross. And we tied it together with a very beautiful French 1920s silent film in black and white that depicts the life of Jesus. And when you watch the video, it's quite extraordinary how they even did the special effects, say, of Jesus walking on water and performing some of the miracles. And so it's a blend of this ancient film of the 1920s with modern videography of the Wintershall Theatre Company, and then me sort of offering a reflection on each of the stations.
I did watch it. It's absolutely stunning. And what a unique and innovative way to draw people in. So when you were at Sotheby's, and even when you were at the priest, when you were at Sotheby's and when you were in seminary in Rome, were you using art as part of the way that you prayed?
Yes, because when I set up Christian art when I was in seminary. Mm-hmm. And in a way for me, it was to hold on to something of the old life.
Yes.
And when I look at my writings, so of, say, 6 years ago when I started seminary, 6-7 years ago, the it was more heavily leaning towards the art than, say, towards the spiritual. And now that has shifted as I've made my way through seminary and then was ordained to the priesthood nearly 3 years ago. Now it's much more about sort of the spiritual side of things, and yes, bringing the art into it, but it's slightly shifted. And art for me has always been a wonderful vehicle to bring me closer to God. And I think that's why, as a church as well, we build these magnificent churches, because they induce to prayer.
Well, I think some of us don't realize or forget our history, where when you go to Florence or Rome, especially, and you see all these cathedrals and basilicas, back then, it's not like everybody had a private prayer book where that could aid in their prayer. Sometimes the only aids they had were visual. Is that correct? Can you talk about that?
Yes, it's true. I mean, most people say, if we talk, for example, about the medieval cathedrals that were built here in Europe, most people could not read or write. So one of the best ways for the church to convey the beauty of God was through a beautiful liturgy, and also depicting the life of the Old Testament and the life of Jesus onto its walls, its tapestries, paintings, sculptures. So it was there, yes, on one side to educate, but also on the other side, to really make visible the invisible, and that is very important, that also God, through Jesus, where Jesus is the visible made, so by God sending his son into the world, the invisible God suddenly becomes visible, and therefore we as a church can use the arts, the visible, in order to connect with the invisible.
So you talk a lot about beauty in your videos. There's so many really stunning videos that you have online. And I know that John Paul II wrote a letter to artists, but is there a lot of church writings about the importance of beauty? Because you feel that that really needs to be put front and central in this sort of apostolate that you have.
I think we haven't done enough in the last 40, 50 years as a church. I think we sort of maybe have looked too much upon art as being, oh, well, it's a nice thing to have, but there are other priorities now. And I don't think that's the case. I think beauty is very much something that that are one of our most powerful tools we have in our arsenal as a church. And we should use it. It doesn't necessarily mean that we have to start commissioning new artworks and new artists, but just to reuse, like I do on the website, just to reuse all of the artwork, because most of people will not have seen most of the things that I show on the website. And it's very interesting, because it was a very beautiful document that was issued at the Vatican Council, actually the very first document, Sacrosanctum Concilium, which talks about the beauty of the liturgy, the beauty of music. And there it says, for example, that seminarians should be trained in the arts and in beauty. And it seems that sort of after that, after the Second Vatican Council, I don't know, we've lost our way a bit, I think, with the arts.
We're moving through Holy Week, Father.
Yes.
Lazarus's sister Mary performs quite an act by pouring perfume on Jesus's feet. And instead of showing a painting, you instead show a perfume jar for the first century. Why did you pick a perfume jar instead of a painting?
Because I think paintings, at the end of the day, is always a personal interpretation of the artists towards a gospel story, which is wonderful. And that's when art is really at its best. But at the same time, it's very important when we read the gospels that actually all of that actually happened. These are not just nice stories from 2,000 years ago. So when we then read that Jesus's feet are being anointed with with oils, with very precious perfume, then I think it's important to explain then to people what this perfume was, what this perfume was made of, what the materials are used at the time, and what the vessels were that were containing the perfumes. And I think our readers, I mean, we've got nearly 200,000 daily readers now, they love hearing that actually this kind of perfume bottle that Mary was holding would have looked sort of more or less like what we're showing then on the website.
In addition to that, and some of the other non-painting art pieces that you show are drawings from the catacombs. Can you talk a little bit about those?
Yes, I mean, I would show paintings from the catacombs every day if I wanted to. It's just they're some of the most beautiful illustrations of early Christian art. Of course, those were made at a time that the Christians were being persecuted. So up to 312, when Constantine won the Battle of the Melvian Bridge, after having seen Jesus in a vision the night before, and he converts almost there and then on that day to Christianity. That basically between Jesus and 312, there were these awful persecutions happening. So the church was a hidden church. Mass had to be celebrated in people's houses so that the Roman authorities wouldn't find out. But, the Christians were buried in these catacombs, which were burial grounds, not just for Christians, but also for others. But nevertheless, everything was hidden. And what you see in this hidden way of living one's faith is that there you see the seeds of Christian art emerging, mainly by small symbols that are put on the walls, a little fish to symbolize Christianity, or an anchor, or a sheep, or even you mentioned the raising of Lazarus or earlier, then I mean those things get depicted as well. So it's the first expressions that Christians want to do something pictorially with their faith.
And one of the beauties of your website and of your daily email is that if you go into the catacombs, it's dark down there and there's a little lamp that shows you that drawing. But
Yes.
with the way that you've depicted the art, you can really blow it up and see all the details that you often can't. Father, I want to ask you about the life of the actual artists and how you have somebody like Fra Angelico who was. He's a saint. He was a Dominican friar, and he lived a really holy life. And then you have Caravaggio, who was kind of a scoundrel in a lot of his personal life. How do you think about that in relation to the authenticity of the religious sentiment that is depicted in the piece of art?
Well, I think the simple answer is that they both created art which transcends themselves. So it transcends the artists. So you look at a Fra Angelico painting, even if you don't know that it was painted by Fra Angelico, it has merit and it links us. When we look at it, the beauty just takes us straight to God. And with Caravaggio, it's the same. Yes, he was a scoundrel, as you say, and a very difficult character, even killed someone and had to flee and got into fights. But nevertheless, the art he created goes beyond him as a person. And I think that that's very important, and that you have very much with ancient art, because all these artists, that was their quest to create something that moved beyond them. And I think in this day and age, when you look at contemporary art, it's almost the reverse, because there a lot of the contemporary art that gets made is so linked to the artist, about the artist's feelings, what they think, how they see the world. And in a lot of the art, there is not that sort of transcendence that takes place.
I want to talk for a minute about a Hans Memling painting that you have on your website, and it's a 32 vignettes of the life of Christ, and you have this idea of how to look at the painting with your children or grandchildren. Can you talk about that and sort of an innovative way of drawing young people into art.
Yes, I mean, Hans Memling was a painter born in Bruges, late 14th, early 15th century, and he created this magnificent oil painting on board depicting all the stations of the cross. Well, there's even more than the stations of the cross. It's sort of the life, the last week of Jesus. It starts with Palm Sunday, all the way through the resurrection. And it's just a fun painting to look at because you can tell your children and say, well, try and find as many scenes of Jesus in this painting. And you will find, I can't remember now from the top of my head how many there are, but I think there's 21 or 22 scenes. So it's just a wonderful, joyful, interactive way for children to engage with and to learn about and to learn about faith. And I think that is a very important aspect of our faith. And about art is that ultimately it's something joyful, and the joy of our faith gets always so beautifully conveyed in art.
As we mark Holy Saturday or Silent Saturday, there's a beautiful piece by Hans Holbein the Younger depicting the dead Christ in his tomb. It's a narrow life-size painting. Can you tell us the significance of this space between Good Friday and Easter Sunday and how that painting can help us think about it?
Yes, I think you said it beautifully there. I mean, Holy Saturday and Silent Saturday. In a lot of the languages like German or Flemish or Dutch, or we call it Silent Saturday. And in a way, it conveys that beautifully, that it's just a day where almost, yeah, there is silence, but almost hope seems to be gone as well. And so I think those are great days to choose paintings that are not necessarily conveying the body of Christ lying in the tomb, which is the painting that I chose for this coming week. But even sort of a landscape can work beautifully. Just something that brings us to ourselves and brings this quietness and conveys this quietness. So in other years, I've often used landscapes, and this time I've used quite a difficult picture to look at because it's literally just Christ's body laying in the tomb. So it's this incredibly long horizontal painting. You see a dead Christ. You see from the color of the skin of the painting that Christ is dead, that it's a lifeless body. And I think that's very important to look at that, that actually Christ did die and that he was in his tomb for 3 days and resurrected. So it's a good painting, but it's a very difficult painting to look at.
Have you seen people convert to Christianity through art?
To see it, I'm not sure, but I'd like to think that hopefully quite a few people will convert because of it. I think beauty is a wonderful inroads into the faith. And if I just may, you asked the question, if I just may very briefly expand on that.
Please.
It was from Balthasar, who was a priest theologian of the 1960s. He was very visionary. He said, if you look at the three transcendentals, truth, goodness, and beauty, so transcendentals, we spoke about it before, transcends time and space. So people always look for truth and the beauty and the goodness. He said, the church will be at a time where we won't be able to talk from our pulpits and say, well, listen, let me tell you what the truth is, or let me tell you how to lead a good life. I mean, young people would just run a mile. However, with beauty, it's completely the opposite. He says, we'll have to start with beauty when our church pews are emptying. We have to sort of get people back into our churches through beauty. And then through beauty, they will then learn goodness and truth, get to the other two transcendentals. And so I think beauty definitely sets people on that journey towards God. It's not sort of the final point, but it's this non-intimidating way to introduce people to God. And if I may just give an example, I remember before I went into seminary, I used to come to Westminster Cathedral quite regularly, and at 5 o'clock there's beautiful Vespers sung in Latin by Westminster Cathedral choir. And so sometimes when I was meeting friends in the evening, I said, "Well, yes, let's go for drinks and dinner, but why don't we meet first at 5 o'clock in the cathedral, and then we go somewhere close by?" "Oh, well, I don't go to church." And I said, "No, but you'll see, it's very beautiful. It's just 20 minutes, but you'll love it." And so they come, they listen to these beautifully sort of Gregorian chants of Vespers sung, and lo and behold, at some point in the evening, these friends would always come back to what they experienced there at 5 o'clock. They say, "What is that actually that they sung?" "Ah, well, it's evening prayer, and it gets the same evening prayer gets sung around the whole world." "Ah, really?" And then, so it's just this beauty that sort of instilled something in them that made them curious. And I think that's the power of art.
And are you having a surge of people come into the church at Westminster Cathedral this Easter Vigil?
Yes, there is. I mean, we've noticed in the last year that there's more young people coming to church. And I think it's always hard to know what exactly the reason is, and it's probably several reasons, but we think when we talk about it amongst chaplains here at the cathedral that a lot of it has to do that everything feels very insecure these days. So much political turmoil going on in the world. Young people can sense that what is true at the end of the day. I mean, you've got your truth, I've got my truth, another friend has got his truth. And I think there is in young people this drive. They can sense that there is something true in our Catholic faith. And if they come to church and they see a beautiful liturgy, they say, "Ah, they've been doing this for like over 2,000 years. So there must be something there that is true." And so we see a great curiosity now amongst young people. Yes.
Are you doing any art history programs there at Westminster Cathedral, since that's kind of your lane and your background?
Yes, I give talks. So I went a couple of days ago, I went to seminary to talk to the, we call them the seekers. They are men who are thinking about the priesthood and who are discerning a vocation to the priesthood. And so I went to give a talk to them and about the importance of beauty. So I think it's mainly with talks and giving tours in the cathedral as well, just to point out different things in the fabric and the architecture of the cathedral.
I know that you say that the Pietà is your favorite work of art, which is very fitting for Holy Week. But as we go into Easter, I hope everyone signs up for your email at christian.art because it's free and it comes every day to your inbox. But are there any particular paintings that you can point us to for the octave of Easter to get ready? Maybe if they're not all on your website yet, that you think really express the beauty of Christ's resurrection.
Yes, I mean, if you go on the website, there's a good search facility. So if you type in Good Friday, you will get the paintings of the last 6, 7 years or
Nice.
so.
Okay.
That's a good resource. I think for the resurrection, it's I'd have to think which ones would be my favorite ones. I think probably I would go towards the Italian Renaissance paintings, someone like Andrea Mantegna. Or Raphael, or because there you have a wonderful balance between not yet the highly dramatic with what follows in the Baroque, and not yet, let's say, sort of the stiffness and the rigidity of medieval art. So I think the Renaissance art, definitely for the subject of the resurrection, would have this perfect sort of balance.
And how about Rembrandt? I know that you're from Belgium, so do you look toward the Northern Europeans at all?
Yes, I mean, obviously, from my cultural background, I would prefer Flemish paintings rather than Rembrandt, but I can appreciate them, and I mean, they're wonderful, wonderful paintings. But it wouldn't necessarily be my first choice. But it's just personal preference, yeah.
Father, tell us about the conference that you're having in November in London to draw people from all over the world to talk about Christian art.
Yes, yeah, so as I said, now we have nearly 200,000 daily subscribers to the website. And the thing is, I don't know who these people are who reads who because it's all online. So the initiative of the conference started out of curiosity, my own curiosity, that I just want to meet some people who are reading these daily emails. So the conference will be for 1,300 people on the 14th of November, and we've got very good speakers lined up. The director of the National Gallery here, Rowan Williams, sort of very good speakers. And the theme will be for all of us to get together just for one day, to discuss how beauty and art helps all of us, because I know I'm not unique in loving art and how it brings us closer to God. So I think it'd be just be a very joyous occasion. And the conference will take place on the Saturday, the night before, on the 13th of November. In the evening, we will have a mass here at Westminster Cathedral, which will be a mass for artists that the Archbishop will celebrate. And the conference will end with those who want it, because it's with evensong at Westminster Abbey, because the conference centre is just opposite Westminster Abbey, just for those who want to go to the Abbey as well.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful gathering. And Father Patrick van der Voorst, thank you so much for joining us and helping us to grow our faith through art.
You are more than welcome, Betsy, and God bless. Thank you.
To learn more about Father Patrick van der Voorst's apostolate, go to Christian.art. To follow all the work we do for the Catholic Association, visit us at CatholicAssociation.org.
To Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Ashley McGuire, and we are in the midst of baseball season at the McGuire household, so I'm very excited to talk to our next guest about a brand new film he has created called Baseball Beyond Belief. The movie explores the compelling depths of how baseball and faith intertwine in powerful and surprising ways. And we are excited to have John Scheinfeld with us today. He is the writer, producer, and director of this movie. Welcome to the show, John.
Thanks for having me, Ashley. Happy to be here.
So as I mentioned, we are a baseball family. I'm a baseball mom. I have two boys who play travel ball, and I'm married to a very rabid Mets fan. So I have learned to really love the sport, and gosh, I can't think of anything that is more exciting to me than combining the best sport in America with faith and exploring the ways that those two really parallel each other, mirror each other. So I understand the movie is based on the New York Times best-selling book, Baseball as a Road to God by John Sexton.
John's book came out in 2013 and, as you mentioned, became a New York Times bestseller. And it combined two things that you don't really connect in any significant way, religion and baseball. And I had done a film back in 2008 about Chicago's love affair with the Chicago Cubs. And I had worked with a number of the people at Major League Baseball, and we were looking for a new project that we might do. And it took many years. But one day in 2019, I got a call from Nick Trotta at Major League Baseball, who said, I'm going to send you this book, and I'm wondering if you think there's a documentary in it. And I read the book and I was absolutely fascinated by it. As I say, it combined two things that I would not have thought is possible to combine. But it raised some really thoughtful, smart, fun, and entertaining issues about both subjects. And I was just thinking this would make a great, uplifting, inspiring film. And that's what really got me interested. We've been working on it for a few years. We got sidetracked by COVID and some other issues. But I'm just really proud of this picture and happy that it's finally coming out.
We have one of those posters in our house, which has every major league stadium and it comes with the sticker. And my husband is one by one taking one of my sons. It's funny, now my next son has also become a big baseball fan, so I think the trips are going to start expanding, but slowly checking off each major league stadium. And I loved in the movie where it talks about stadiums as like cathedrals, but talk a little bit about that parallel of like sacred spaces and both in religion and what stadiums and mean to sports fans.
Much as people will go to church or temple or synagogue to explore their faith and to experience their traditions, the same is true when you go to your favorite ballpark, whether it's the Mets Park or I'm a Cubs fan, so it's Wrigley, or if you're a Boston Red Sox fan, it's Fenway. These parks all have such great traditions, and there's a distinct feeling when you enter the ballpark. And I think it welcomes you into this tradition. In the case of baseball, that's what the ballparks do. And so I think that's really fascinating. But you talk about your husband being such a devout fan and your kids playing, then I'm sure you see this, where as you're rooting for your team, you have faith in them, but yet you will have doubt that they're actually going to win this game, or the pitcher is going to strike out the batter that he needs to strike out, or they're going to make the big play in the outfield. There are rituals. There's a sense of community. You can be at a ball game and there will be a miracle in real time, somebody making a terrific defensive play or a great hit. So these are some of the hallmarks of both religion and baseball, and that's what fascinated us in this film.
Yeah, talk about miracles. I loved the Kirk Gibson story you featured. Feels almost like a supernatural miracle to baseball fans.
Absolutely. It was the World Series, and it was just not anything that the Dodgers were going to win. They were behind. It was the bottom of the ninth. They bring up to bat Kirk Gibson, who is hobbling on one leg, can barely walk, can barely heft a bat, and yet they send him out there. What we were able to do in the film, mostly when you see highlights of this game, you just see the home run that he hits that wins the game for the Dodgers. But what we were able to do, because we had access to the Major League Baseball archive, so we got to show you the few plays that or the few pitches that led up to that home run. And what you see is this guy's really struggling.
Yeah.
He can barely hit it. He can't really run up to first base. The announcers are telling us that he's been struggling with this for days and wasn't even going to suit up for this game. And yet he does. And he hits this, I would call it the immaculate conception of home runs in terms of you didn't expect it to happen, but yet there it is. They win the game. And it qualifies, I guess, in baseball sense as a miracle.
One thing I was surprised to see in the movie were some interviews with actual chaplains. And I had no idea there was such a thing as team chaplains. And how long has that been a part of baseball?
I can't really answer that question, Ashley. I don't know about every team, but there are a number of chaplains in Major League Baseball. We interviewed Willie Alfonso, who is the chaplain for the New York Yankees. And his job is to be a spiritual advisor to the players as they need it. But also he will have a prayer service before the game, both for the home team and the visiting team, and just kind of be there if they need to talk about something. Willie is a fascinating character who experienced his own redemption in life. He had gone down a very bad path in terms of drug addiction, and he was homeless for a while. And by putting his faith in God, he turned his life around, and now here he is, chaplain to one of the primary franchises in Major League Baseball. And as he said to me in the interview, he said, sometimes it's better not to open up your mouth. Sometimes it's better just to listen. And that's, I think, how he views his job as the chaplain, is to listen to the people that come to talk to him, see what's on their mind. And then if they ask, or if he feels that he can offer something important, he will say so. Like you, I did not know this was a job in Major League Baseball, but here it is, and I'm glad we could include him in our film. Fascinating character.
Talk about the two priests you feature who go to baseball games. I believe they were Franciscans, and they made an interesting comment about how, you know, there used to be this thing called street preaching, and preachers and priests would go into the street, but they said that's not really where people gather anymore, and and they tend to gather in sports events. And talk a little bit about their ministry. They were really fun.
Yeah, really fascinating guys. Father Casey and Father Tito, Franciscans, as you mentioned. They look, depending what your age and frame of reference is, they dress and they look either like Friar Tuck out of the Robin Hood movies, or they look like they're right out of a Star Wars film. But they're young guys who love baseball. And they decided that, yes, as they couldn't go out into the town square and preach the gospel, that they thought they would go to places where people do gather. And as baseball fans, they said, let's go to every baseball park in America. And so one summer, they went out to all 32 ballparks. And they weren't proselytizing in the sense of getting in people's faces and talking. They really just made themselves available. And because of the way they look in these robes, people would come up to them and said, well, what are you? And sometimes they would joke, well, may the force be with you. We're Jedi. And that would lead to some other kind of conversation. But a lot of times they would talk baseball, and a lot of times they would actually talk more spiritual matters. They talk about a gentleman that came up to them that was just dealing with the passing of a parent from cancer and didn't quite know how to deal with it. And they ended up talking about it, and the friars gave him some comfort. And so I thought, again, this was a perfect way to show this intersection of baseball and faith. You have these two young friars who are baseball fans. Not only do they merge the two subjects in their own lives, but by going to the 32 ballparks, they then can combine this in other people's lives as well.
So I've thought about writing about this because it has started to feel like going to a baseball game is almost not family friendly, because the expense, the difficulty, even sometimes some of the music, and yet it's still such a wonderful rite of passage, a way especially for fathers and sons to bond. But can you talk a little bit about the role of baseball in family life and sort of forging these traditions with fathers and sons, and even sometimes the kind of friendly interfamily rivalries with teams and things like that?
Well, I cannot tell you how many people we talked to that all had a similar experience where, as a child, their father took them to a game or introduced them to baseball on television and took out a scorecard and showed their son how to score a game for nine innings. And it's a little bit like religion in a way also, where as a child, you don't choose whether you're going to have faith. You don't choose what your faith is going to be. You are raised in a tradition of your parents. And much the same for baseball. If the father is a Yankee fan, you are likely to be a Yankee fan. We have a couple of examples that we talk about in the film about conversion, where you're much like some people will convert from one faith to another. Some people may also convert from rooting for one team and then start rooting for another. We have a lovely, touching, emotional story of John Sexton, who wrote the book, who had been raised a Brooklyn Dodger fan, and the Yankees were the, you'll pardon the expression, the Antichrist for him. But as he grew up, his son decided that he was going to root for the Yankees. And so here was a father who had a decision to make. Am I going to try to force my son to root for the Dodgers, as I always have since I was a kid, or am I going to support him in his faith in the Yankees? And he decided he would convert to being a Yankee fan. But I think it's very much the traditions of baseball and the traditions of faith that the parents and children can share together. And we see this in multiple ways in our film.
The film talks a lot about how baseball mirrors religion. We've talked a little bit about this, but give a few more examples. For example, you refer in the film to the World Series as the High Holy Days, or you talk about some of these moments in a baseball game that are almost like liturgical, like the national anthem. But what are some of the other ways that a baseball game and the baseball season mirrors faith and religion, and specifically specific practices and things like that?
Well, we can talk about sacred times of the year. So depending on what your faith is, you have Christmas, you have Easter, you you have Hanukkah, whatever it may be. But in baseball, it's opening day. Is a sacred time of the year for baseball fans of all teams. Sacred, I think, because everyone is starting out with a fresh start. You're 0-0, and the World Series is ahead of you at some point. And that's the other sacred time of the year, is the World Series. That means so much to baseball fans and baseball players. We have rituals. If you think about it, if you go to church, if you go to temple, there are rituals with prayers and psalms and people expressing their faith in different ways. And the same thing is true when you go to a baseball park. You see the rituals of the players. Sometimes we have some film in our picture about people who will jump over the third base line because it's a tradition. Somehow they feel they're going to play better if they do that. There are also rituals of they will wear the same socks for one game after another because they keep winning and they think it's the lucky socks that do that. So rituals can play in it. I think also a great sense of community. I think if you go to the ballpark and you're rooting for your team, it doesn't matter what age you are, doesn't matter what sex you are, doesn't matter what race you are, doesn't matter what your politics are. You are all in this space to root for your team. And that gives a real sense of community, a sense of belonging. And I think that is true also when you go to church or temple, synagogue, where you are with people who believe in the same principles and traditions that you do. And you are then in a community of like-minded people. So those are some other ways that do that.
You know, I have to say it's so true. I'm a busy mom with 5 kids, and people are always shocked at how much time I spend at my son's baseball games. And what I love about it is the way it forces me to slow down. And I just sit there and just kind of watch. I take in, I chat with people. I often bring my little kids and they just ride their bikes by. And it's a very peaceful part of my week that I love. One other thing, you know, you were talking about sacred moments. For me, it's the pitchers and catchers report. That to me is like, I'm Catholic. That's like when you ring the bell, like, okay, it's begun. Quick last question. You know, there's a lot of these athletes today, you know, are there any men in the MLB that you see really kind of speaking out about their faith? I'm noticing a lot of that, but is that something you're seeing?
Well, you know, it was interesting, Ashley. When we were booking interviews for the film, we reached out to a lot of players. We did get two really terrific players, Curtis Granderson and Sean Green. And they were very happy to talk about their faith. But what I did find what was very interesting is we reached out to a number of players. And while they acknowledged the value in what we were attempting to accomplish in this film, they felt that their faith was very private and it was something for them and their families. And they didn't really want to speak about it publicly. So that I thought was kind of an interesting expression of their faith. A lot of people are sort of out there saying, yes, I believe this, and I'm very excited about this. And the other people that were very private about it. Something about baseball players who live their lives in public every day or every other day makes it, I think, a more private expression of faith for them. And so that's what we discovered. What you do see, though, is sort of unspoken expressions of faith. And we see that in many different ways, where after a player has a great play, they will cross themselves or they will kiss their lips and point up to the heavens. So I think there are other ways in which they do that. It isn't always simply talking about it.
Well, I just love the way your film does bring to light the beautiful way that America's pastime reflects kind of our human innate spirituality. And so love the movie. Tell our listeners, where can they find it? Where can they stream it? Is it coming to theaters? Where can they watch it?
We're opening up in New York at the Village East Theater for a week-long engagement, and I'll be in New York doing some Q&As on the first 2 nights. And then after that, there's going to be a very special broadcast of the film on Easter Sunday on Fox Sports One.
Beautiful.
It's going to be a slightly trimmed down version of the film. So if people want to see the full film, please come to the theater and see it. And then after the Fox Sports broadcast, we'll be on various video on demand platforms where people can seek it out. So again, the title of the film is Baseball Beyond Belief, which we love as a title, by the way, because it speaks to, again, both sides. You can be just a baseball fan and say, oh, baseball's just beyond belief. I love going to games. It's great. It's great for my kids. Blah, blah, blah. But also it's beyond belief. Because you can believe in your faith, and there is something beyond that in the experience of bringing these things together that I think is a worthy endeavor. So I'm very proud, as I say, of this picture, and I hope your listeners will check us out.
Well, we've been talking with John Scheinfeld, the filmmaker of Baseball Beyond Belief. I've watched it. It's a wonderful movie. Great for watching during spring break and Easter season. So I encourage all our listeners to watch it. And thank you, John, for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Ashley. Appreciate it.
Welcome back to Conversations with Consequences, where I am joined by TCA Chaplain Monsignor Roger Landry. And we are in Holy Week. Monsignor Landry, how can we get ready for the big Triduum that we're all been preparing for the last 5.5 weeks?
So the Triduum is the most important part of the Catholic Church's liturgical year. And so we really have to take it seriously. Holy Thursday isn't a holy day of obligation because any serious Catholic would never go to Mass just simply because he has to. This is the greatest invitation that we'll ever receive from the Lord himself, who is eagerly desiring to eat the Passover with us before he suffers. And so for us to go there, the church always says there are three things we mark at Holy Thursday. The first thing is we mark the institution of the Holy Eucharist, that Jesus has given himself. And I can't stress enough that it wasn't enough that Jesus took on our human nature and entered our world. He loved us more than that. It wasn't enough that he was crucified for us and rose on the third day. He loved us more than that. The ultimate of his saving plan was for us to enter into literal Holy Communion with him through eating his flesh and drinking his blood. And so the Eucharist is the summit of salvation history. And that's what we mark tonight, that he loved us enough that we were going to be able to have the experience that Mary had when she gestated him for 9 months. We received the same Jesus within. She carried that entire time. The only difference is his appearances. The only difference is his humility. Beyond just taking on our human nature as a one-cell embryo and then growing just like we grow, he hides himself under what seemed to be the physical appearances of bread and wine, but there's no bread and wine there. This is the mind-blowing, awesome reality of the Holy Eucharist, and we mark that on Holy Thursday. It's the first thing we mark. Second is what makes the Eucharist possible, which is the institution of the Holy Priesthood, which is what he did on Holy Thursday as well in that upper room, where he told his first apostles, do this in memory of me. Not just do something in memory of me, do this in memory of me, that the way we're going to keep Jesus with us always until the end of time in a living memorial, which is the way the Jews always looked at a memorial. It wasn't just an event in the past. It was bringing the past, actualizing it in the future. The way we'd remember Jesus and actualize our communion with him is through the Mass. And so he, on Holy Thursday, ordained his first priests, and they've been ordaining priests ever since. And then we likewise mark his command of fraternal love, the rubrics call it, that Jesus washed the feet of the apostles, kind of like a sacrament of penance almost, in preparation for Mass, because they had already been washed, Jesus said in those words, which point to the sacrament of baptism. But they just needed to be cleansed of what actually came into physical contact in the world as they were traversing the day-to-day dirty streets of ancient Jerusalem and Palestine and Israel, etc. And so Jesus said, I've done this as an example so that just as I have done for you, you may also do. And so Jesus wants us to do the dirty work. He wants us to love others as he has loved us. He wants us to do whatever it takes, including washing their feet, the work of a slave, in order to be able to bring them to life. And so we mark all three of those realities on Holy Thursday. And it's particularly special. If you love your parish priests and you want to do something for them, show up on Holy Thursday. This is the institution of the priesthood. They're there for the Eucharist. And if they celebrate Holy Thursday in an empty church because Catholics are watching NCAA basketball or anything else like this, it can suck a little bit of the spiritual wind out of them. But if people show up in great numbers because they want to be there, what a gift that is to your parish priests. And then, of course, we shift to Good Friday, the one day during the year, Betsy, where I encourage Catholics, if they don't already have it off from work, to just take it off from work. We would take a day off from work if our mom or our dad, our husband, our wife, our son or daughter, our best friend, our brother or our sister were dying. Why would we do less for Jesus? And to make that time to be able to come and ponder just how much he loved us, that he would go through all of that to save us, to take away our sins. Just out of gratitude, we need to be there. You know, there are many opportunities on a Good Friday for us to pray the Station of the Cross, for us to begin the Novena of Divine Mercy. But there are two that are the most traditional and I think the most powerful. The first is that Passion service in which we ponder St. John's version of the Passion. A lot of the times it's sung very beautifully, especially in cathedral. And then we have a chance to venerate the cross of Jesus in which we genuflect it toward it on this one day during the year. We kiss the cross or kiss Jesus' body, often without shoes on or sandals, just as a thing of humility. And then we're able to receive the fruit of that cross, which is the tree of life, which is Jesus's sacred body and Holy Communion consecrated the night before. It's the one day in the year we don't have Mass, but we are able to receive the real fruit of the Mass, Jesus himself in Holy Communion. The other main activity, which I had the privilege to preach last year in New York, is the seven last words of Jesus, the seven things that through excruciating pain he enunciated because he wanted us to understand what he was thinking as he was saving us on Calvary. And so, especially in big cities, you have the seven last words. They'll be at St. Patrick's in New York, preached by somebody else this year, but I'm very grateful that Archbishop Hicks, the new Archbishop of New York, has asked me to preach the Good Friday Passion Service. So anytime I have the privilege to preach at St. Patrick's, it's always a very beautiful thing. And anybody across the country who might not have access to those in their parish churches, you could go to St. Patrick's Cathedral website from New York and be able to follow it even from home. And then Holy Saturday is the culmination of the church's liturgical year. And we've got the most beautiful and by far the longest Mass of the year. It's got a ceremony in which we bless the Easter fire and light the Easter candle off of it, which is symbolic and ancient and something we all should know. Then we have the longest feast of the Word of God, 17 courses, seven Old Testament readings, seven Psalms, a New Testament reading, another Psalm. And then we have the Gospel that we proclaim at the Easter Vigil. It is so rich as we go through all of salvation history, culminating in what Jesus did. Then we have the baptisms of the new adults who are coming into the church, who have been preparing, many of them for 9 months or longer, in order to be able to enter the church. And we are more related to our new brothers and sisters by the blood of Jesus than I am to my identical twin brother Scott by genes. And we need to live that reality. We're welcoming new family members. And so we come, and sometimes in a lot of places this year, we've had huge upticks in the amount who want to become Catholic. And so we're going to be able to cheer them on at the starting line of their Catholic life so that together with them, we're able to sprint in the pilgrimage of the church to eternity. And then, of course, we have the celebration of the liturgy of the Eucharist in which we're able to receive the risen body, blood, soul, and divinity of Jesus as its culmination. The double Alleluias, everything else that are sung, it's so incredibly joyful. And so this is the time for us to show, because we love the Lord, how much we love him by accompanying him closely through the Last Supper, through Calvary, through the his bursting forth from the tomb. And so I am so excited, as you can hear. I'm almost not letting you get in a word in edgewise, Betsy, as we enter into these great mysteries.
Thank you so much for a really detailed explanation of why each one of these services and masses is so important for the next 4 days. Would you give us a Easter blessing?
Sure. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May the blessing of the risen Lord Jesus, the Father who loved us enough to send him to us, and the Holy Spirit who helps us to give joint witness to the fact that Jesus is very much alive, descend upon you and remain with you forever.
Amen. Amen. Thank you, Monsignor Landry.
God bless you, Betsy. Happy Easter.
Happy Easter. Be sure to join us next week where Monsignor Landry gives us a full scope of all the things we have to look forward to with the coming beatification of the Venerable Fulton J. Sheen in September.